this morning and took him over to the Dennett's when, lo and behold, I find out Eve and Mia have moved out. I make the jaunt to Wrigleyville and surprise the women at 10 a.m. with a dozen donuts, cafe mochas, and a malnourished tabby cat. They're both in their pajamas watching TV. I catch the door as someone is leaving so I don't have to wait to be buzzed in. I like the surprise of it. "Good morning," I say when Mia opens the door. She wasn't expecting me. Eve rises from the couch and pats at her untidy hair. "Gabe," she says. She pulls on a robe to make sure nothing is exposed. I attempt to leave the cat in the hall, but so help me, all it takes is a thank you from Mia in response to my, "I brought some donuts and coffee," and the cat goes absolutely berserk, clawing at the bars of the cage and making noises I've never heard a cat make before. So much for my grand entrance. Eve turns white. "What is that noise?" she asks, and so I bring the little guy in and close the door. According to research, people who live with animals have decreased anxiety and lower blood pressure. They have lower cholesterol. They are more relaxed and less stressed and are overall in better health. Unless, of course, you have a dog who pees uncontrollably wherever it wishes or eats your furniture to shreds. "What are you doing with that cat?" Eve asks. She's clearly at a loss and thinks I'm off my rocker. "This little guy?" I ask. I play dumb. I squat down and open the cage and take the cat into my arms. He claws me with his back claws. Shit. I'm watching him for a friend of mine. "I hope you don't mind. Is anyone allergic to cats?" I ask, setting him on the ground and standing to meet Mia in the eye. The fur ball jaunts over to her and does about 1,000 figure eights around her legs. He's meowing. His insides purr. Eve laughs. She runs a hand through her hair. "Looks like you have a friend, Mia," she says. The girl is muttering something under her breath, as if trying a new word on for size, before she blurts it out and astounds us all. She lets that cat grope her for I don't know how long as we listen to Eve go on and on about how taken the little guy is with Mia's feet. "What's that you said?" I ask, stepping forward as she leans down and scoops the cat into her arms. He doesn't scratch her. They nuzzle noses and he bumps into her face with his head. "I always told her she should get a cat," Eve continues to babble. "Mia," I say. She looks at me with tears in her eyes. She knows that I know, and that I did this for a reason. "Canoe," she whispers to me. I said canoe. "Canoe?" "It's his name." "Whatever happened to Max or Fido?" "Canoe? What kind of name is that?" "Mia, honey." Eve comes to her side, aware for the first time that something is happening here. "Whose name's Canoe?" she asks. Her voice is dumbed down, as if she's talking to a mentally challenged child. She's certain Mia is talking gibberish, a side effect of the ASD. Except this is the first time I've ever seen Mia say something that makes sense. "Eve," I say, ever so gently prying her hand off Mia's arm. I reach into my coat pocket and pull out the fax I sent to the cops in Grand Marais and unfold it to reveal a perfectly sketched image of little Canoe. "This," I say, holding it out to her, "is Canoe."
"Then he isn't..."
"There was a shed," Mia is saying. She doesn't look at us. Her eyes are lost on the cat. Eve takes the drawing from my hand. She knows now. She's seen the sketchbook, every last image down to the drawing of Colin Thatcher that she told me kept her awake at night. But she had forgotten the cat. Eve sinks into the couch. "There was a shed behind the cabin. He was living in there. I found him sleeping in an old rusty canoe. I scared him the first time. I just threw open the door to have a look around and scared him half to death. He ran away, out a small hole in the shed, and flew like a bat out of hell through the woods. I never thought he'd come back. But he was hungry, and I'd left out food. He said there was no way in hell a cat was staying with us. No way in hell." "Who said that, Mia?" I ask. Of course, I know. I should have been the damn shrink. But her answer is unexpected. "Owen," she says, and then she begins to sob, laying a hand on the wall to steady herself.
"Mia, honey, who is Owen? There is no Owen. The man in the cabin, that man is Colin Thatcher."
"Eve," I say. My self-worth is increasing by the second.
I managed to do what a Ph.D. couldn't. I got Mia placing herself in the cabin with the man named Owen and a cat named Canoe. He went by a number of aliases. Owen is probably just another one of them. "Is there anything else you remember?" I asked. "Can you tell me anything else about him?" "We should call Dr. Rhodes," Eve interrupts. I know she means well. She has Mia's best interest at heart, but I can't let that happen. She reaches into her purse and I say her name. Enough has passed between us that Eve knows she can trust me. I won't let anything happen to Mia. She looks at me and I shake my head. Not now. This is getting good. He said that he hated cats, and that if he saw it in the cabin, he'd shoot it. He didn't mean it. Of course he didn't, or I wouldn't have let the cat in.
Did he have a gun?
Yes. Of course he did. I know he did.
Were you afraid of him, Mia? Did you think he might shoot you?
She's nodding, yes.
But then she stops.
No.
She shakes her head.
I don't know. I don't think so.
Well, of course you were, honey. He had a gun. He kidnapped you.
Did he threaten you with a gun?
Yes,
she's thinking. She wakes up from a dream and tries to remember the details. She gets bits and pieces, but never the whole thing. We've all been there. In a dream, your house is a house, but it's not your house. Some lady doesn't look like your mother, but you know that she is your mother. In the daytime, it doesn't quite make as much sense as it did during the night.
He held me down. Outside, in the woods, he pointed the gun at me. He was so mad. He was screaming.
She's shaking her head vigorously. Tears fall freely down her cheeks. It's making Eve a nervous wreck. I have to step between the women to keep Eve back.
Why?
I ask. My voice is calm, subdued. Maybe I was a shrink in a former life.
It's my fault. It's all my fault.
What's your fault, Mia?
I tried to tell him.
Tried to tell him what?
He wouldn't listen. He had the gun. He kept pointing it at me. I knew if anything went wrong, he was going to kill me.
He told you that? I ask. He said if anything went wrong, he would kill you?
No, no, she shakes her head. She looks me right in the eye. I could see it in his eyes. She says that she was scared that day in the bar. She tried not to be, but she was scared. My mind does an about-face to the jazz bar in Uptown, the balding proprietor in fancy green candle. This is where Mia first encountered Colin Thatcher, a.k.a. Owen. From the waitress's testimony, Mia left in a hurry, of her own free will. I think back to the waitress's words. Seemed to me she couldn't wait to get out of here. Doesn't sound like fear to me.
And then, Mia cries, everything was going wrong. I tried to tell him. I should have just told him, but I was scared. He had the gun, and I knew that if anything went wrong, he'd kill me. I tried to...
Colin Thatcher, I interrupt. Owen. Owen would kill you if anything went wrong.
She nods, then quickly shakes her head.
Yes, no.
She's frustrated.
I don't know.
She splutters.
What did you try to tell him?
I ask instead, but her mind is a 180 and she shakes her head, stymied, frustrated. She can no longer remember what she was about to say. Most people think there are two natural responses to fear, fight or flight. But there's a third reaction to a bad situation. Freeze, like a deer in headlights. Play dead. Mia's words, I was scared, I tried to tell him, proved just that. There was no fight or flight response. She froze. There she was, on high alert, adrenaline pumping, but unable to do anything to save her life.
It's all my fault,
she says again. What's your fault? I ask, expecting a replay of the same conversation. But this time she says, I tried to run away.
And he caught you.
She's nodding. I recall her earlier admission, outside in the woods, I ask. And he was mad at you for trying to run away. So he pointed the gun at you and told you that if you ever tried that again, that he would kill me.
Eve gasps.
She covers her gaping mouth with her hand. Of course he threatened to kill her. That's what they do. I'm sure it happened many times.
What else did he say? I query.
What can you remember?
She's shaking her head. She comes up with nothing.
Canoe, I prompt. You said he'd shoot him if he saw him in the cabin, but he didn't.
You remember that the cat was in the cabin.
She strokes the cat's fur. She doesn't look at me.
He said he laid by me for days.
He never left my side.
Who didn't? I ask.
He said no one had ever loved him as much in his life. No one had ever been as devoted.
As who?
She looks at me. Duh, her eyes say. Canoe. And that's when it hits me. If seeing the cat brought this much back to life, what memories could we exhume if we place Mia back in the homely log cabin? I have to find the person that did this to her before I know for sure that she and Eve are safe.
Colin, before. I tell her we're going for a walk. It's dark outside, after 10 p.m.
Now?
She asks, as if we have something better to do. Now. She tries to argue, but I won't have it. Not this time. I help her into my coat and we head outside. The snow is falling lightly and the temperature hovers right around 32 degrees. The snow is light. It's perfect for a snowball fight. It brings me back to the trailer park, tossing snowballs with the other trailer trash kids before Ma bought a home that wasn't mobile. She follows me down the steps. At the bottom, she stops to take it all in. The sky is black. The lake is lost to oblivion. It would be dark, too dark, without the brilliance of the snow. She catches it into her hands, and the snow collects in her hair and on her eyelashes. I stick out my tongue to taste it. The night is silent. Out here, the snow makes everything glow. It's brisk outside, not cold. One of those nights that the snow somehow makes you feel warm. She's standing at the bottom of the steps. The snow is up to her ankles. Come here, I say. We trudge through the snow for the crappy little shed out back. I pry the door open. I have to force the damn thing through the snow to get inside. It isn't easy. She helps me pull and then says,
"What are you looking for?"
when we're inside. "This," I say, holding up an axe. I thought I'd seen it in here before. 2 months ago, she would have thought the axe was meant for her.
"What's that for?"
she asks. She isn't scared. I have a plan. You'll see. The snow must be 4 inches by now, maybe more. Our feet slosh in it and the legs of our pants become soaked. We walk for a while until the cabin is no longer in sight. We're on a mission, and that in itself is vitalizing. "Ever cut down your own Christmas tree?" I ask. She looks at me like I'm nuts, like only some crazy hick would cut down their own Christmas tree. But then I see that hesitation flee. She says to me,
"I've always wanted to cut my own Christmas tree."
Her eyes light up like a child's. She says that at her home, it was always fake. Real trees were messy. Her mother would never go for it. There was nothing fun about Christmas in her home. It was all for appearances' sake. The tree was decked out with all these breakable crystal ornaments. She'd get yelled at for coming within 3 feet of the thing. I tell her to pick it out, whichever one she wants. She points to a 60-foot fir. "Try again," I say. But for a moment, I stare it down and wonder if I could. I convince myself that she's having fun. She doesn't mind the cold or the way the snow gets caught in the ankle of her sock. She says that her hands are freezing. She presses them to my cheeks to feel, but I can't feel a thing. My own cheeks are numb. I tell her that as a kid, my mother and I forgot about Christmas. She'd drag me to Mass, but as for the presents and trees and all that shit, well, we didn't have the money. And I never wanted my mother to feel guilty about it, so I just let December 25th come and go like it was any other day. Back in school, the kids would all brag about what they'd gotten. I'd always make something up. I didn't feel sorry for myself. I wasn't one to feel sorry for myself. I tell her that I never believed in Santa Claus. Not one day of my life.
"What did you want?"
she asks. What I wanted was a dad. Someone to take care of my mother and me, so I didn't have to do it myself. But what I tell her is Atari. She finds a tree. It's about 5 feet tall. "You want to try?" I ask, and hand her the axe. holding it in her hands. She laughs. It's a sound I've never heard before. She gives the tree a whack. After 4 or 5 tries, she hands me the axe. I examine the base. She's made a dent, but not much more. It's not like it's easy. I tell her to stand back as I whack the hell out of it. She's watching with the wide eyes of a 5-year-old child. I'll be damned if I don't cut down this tree. The entire world is quiet. Everything is at peace. I'm sure I've never experienced a night as perfect as this before. She tells me that it's impossible to believe that somewhere out there, the world is at war. People are starving. Children are being abused. We're removed from civilization, she says.
2 tiny figurines in a snow globe that some child has turned over.
I picture it, us trudging across ceramic mounds while glittery snow encircles us in our own bubble. In the distance, I'm certain I hear an owl hoot. I stop her and say, shh. And for a moment, we listen. This is where the snowy owl migrates in the winter. We're freezing to death, but he comes here to keep warm. We listen. It's quiet. She looks toward the sky and watches the clouds burst at the seams. They shower us with snow. The tree is heavy. We haul it in together, her in front, me in the back. We slide it across the snow, and 4 or 5 times, one or both of us slides on the snow and falls. Our hands are so cold, they're hardly able to grasp the trunk of the tree. When we get to the cabin, I take the base of the tree. Moving backward, I heave it up the steps. She stands at the bottom. She pretends to help, but we both know that she does nothing. We force it through the front door and prop it against a wall. I collapse. The tree must weigh 150 pounds, sopping wet and overflowing with heavy snow. I kick off my wet shoes and gulp water right from the kitchen faucet. She lets her hands wander across the juvenile leaves, still filled with snow. She smells the pine. It's the first time neither of us complains of being cold. Our hands are raw, our noses and cheeks red. But under layers of clothes, we sweat. I stare at her, her skin alive from the cold. I go into the bathroom to clean up and change my clothes. She wipes the moisture from the floor, from under the tree and where our shoes pooled snow. I can smell the pine on my hands. I feel the sticky sap. I breathe hard, trying to catch my breath. I drop to the couch when I return. She heads into the bathroom to strip the wet clothes from her skin. She sinks into an extra pair of long johns that have been drying on the window curtain, and when she comes out, she says,
"No one's ever given me a tree before."
I'm rekindling the fire as she passes through the room. She watches my calculating hands manipulate the wood just right, bringing the fire to life. She says that I do everything that way, with a certain expertise I pretend doesn't exist. I don't say a thing. I sit back on the couch and drape a blanket over my legs. My feet rest on a coffee table. I'm still breathing hard. "What I would give for a beer," I say. She watches me sitting there for I don't know how long. I can feel her eyes on me. "You too?" I ask after a minute.
"A beer?"
"Yeah."
"Yeah,"
she says. I remember the two of us sitting side by side, drinking beer in that bar. I ask her if she remembers, and she says yes. She says it seems like a million years ago, long before someone glued us to the lid of an empty baby food jar and filled our world with glitter.
"What time is it?"
she asks. My watch rests on the table beside my feet. I lean forward for a look. I say that it's 2 a.m.
"Are you tired?"
she asks. "Getting there."
"Thank you for the tree,"
she says.
"Thank you for getting us a tree,"
she adds. She doesn't want to be presumptuous. I stare at the tree, leaning against the log wall. It's misshapen, homely. But she says it's perfect. "No," I say. "It's for you. So you stop looking so damn sad." I promise to find lights for it. I don't know how, but I promise I'll do it. She tells me not to worry about it.
It's perfect the way it is,
she says. But I say I'll find the lights. She asks if I ever ride the L. I give her a dumb look. I say, yes, of course I do. You can hardly get around Chicago without riding the L, the city's rapid transit system. She says that she rides the Red Line most of the time.
Flying under the city as if all that commotion above ground doesn't exist. Do you ever ride the bus?
She asks. I wonder where the hell she's going with this. Sometimes.
Go out? To bars? Stuff like that?
Sometimes. I shrug. It's not really my crowd.
But you do.
I guess. Sometimes.
You ever go by the lake?
I know a guy who's got a boat at Belmont Harbor. And by that I mean some lowlife like me. Some guy working for Dalmar who lives in a boat. A used cruiser he keeps gassed and docked in case he needs to run. He's got enough provisions on that boat that he could last for at least a month traveling up the Great Lakes to Canada. This is how people like us live. Always ready to run. She nods. Belmont Harbor, of course. She says she runs by there all the time.
I could have seen you before. We might have passed on the street, ridden together on the bus, maybe waited underground for the same L.
Millions of people live in Chicago.
But maybe.
I guess. Maybe. What are you getting at?
I'm just wondering.
Her voice trails off. What? I ask.
If we would have ever met, if it wasn't for...
This? I shake my head. I'm not trying to be an ass. It's just the truth. Probably not.
You don't think so?
We wouldn't have met. I say again.
How do you know?
We wouldn't have met. I look away, draw the blanket to my neck and lie down on my side. I ask her to turn off the light, and when she hovers in the kitchen, I say, "Aren't you going to bed?"
How can you be sure?
She asks instead. I don't like where this conversation is headed. What difference does it make? I ask.
Would you have talked to me if we did meet? That night, would you have ever talked to me if you didn't have to?
I wouldn't have been in that bar in the first place.
But if you were...
No.
No?
I wouldn't have talked to you. The rejection slaps her across the face.
Oh.
She crosses the room and turns off the light. But I can't leave it like that. I can't let her go to bed pissed. In the darkness, I admit, it's not what you think. She's defensive. I've hurt her feelings.
What do I think?
It has nothing to do with you.
Of course it does.
Mia?
Then what?
Mia.
What?
It has nothing to do with you. It doesn't mean anything. But it does. It does to her. She's walking toward the bedroom when I admit, the first time I saw you, you were coming out of your apartment. I was just across the street, sitting on the steps of some four flat, just waiting. I'd seen a picture. I called from a payphone on the corner. You answered, and I hung up. I knew you were there. I don't know how long I waited. 45 minutes, maybe an hour. I had to know what I'd gotten myself into. And then I saw you through the little windows on the side of the front door. I saw you jog down the steps with your headphones on. You opened the door and sat down outside to tie a shoe. I memorized your hair, the way it fell over your shoulders before you took these long arms and tied it back. A woman passed by with like 4 or 5 dogs. She said something to you and you smiled, and I thought to myself that I'd never seen anything so... I don't know. I'd never seen anything so beautiful in my life. You went off running down the road and I waited. I watched cabs drive by and hordes of people walk home from the bus stop at the corner. It was 6, maybe 7 o'clock. It started to get dark. The sky was one of those dramatic fall skies. You were walking when you returned. You passed right in front of me and then jogged across the street, waving to a cab that slowed down to let you pass. I was almost certain you saw me. You dug in your shoe for a key and let yourself in, up the steps where I couldn't see you. I saw the light in your window and your silhouette. I imagined what you might be doing inside. I imagined myself in there with you, what it would be like, if it didn't have to be like this. She's quiet. And then she says that she remembers the night. She says she remembers the sky, so vibrant, as the sunlight was scattered by particles in the sky. She says that the sky was the color of persimmon and sangria, shades of red only God could make. She says,
I remember the dogs. 3 black labs and a golden retriever, and the woman, all 90-some pounds of her, swept away in a tangle of leashes.
She says she remembers the call, though at the time it left her unfazed. She remembers sitting inside feeling alone because that damn boyfriend of hers was working, but more so, because she was glad he was.
I didn't see you,
she whispers.
If I did, I'd remember.
She lowers herself onto the couch beside me. I open the blanket for her and she slides in. She presses her back into me, a vacuum seal. I can feel the rhythm of her heart pressing against me. I can feel the blood pulsing through my own ears. It's loud enough, I'm sure she hears. I wrap the blanket over her. I reach across her, find her hand, and our fingers lace together. Her grasp is reassuring. In time, mine stops to shake. I slide my bottom arm under the crevice of her neck. She falls into every gap there is until we become one. I rest my head onto a mat of dirty blonde hair, close enough that she can feel the exhalation of air on her skin, reassuring her that we're alive, though inside, we can hardly breathe. We fall into oblivion this way. Into a world where nothing matters. Nothing but us. She's gone when I wake up. I no longer feel her pressed into me. Something is missing. Though it wasn't that long ago that there was nothing there. I see her outside, sitting on the porch step. She's freezing her ass off. It doesn't appear that she minds. The blanket is wrapped around her shoulders and she's wearing my shoes on her feet. They're huge. She's kicked the snow off the step, though the ends of the blanket lie in it and get wet. I don't go out right away. I make coffee, I find my coat, I take my time. Hey, I offer as I step outside in my bare feet. I hand her a mug of coffee. Thought this would warm you up.
Oh,
she's startled. She eyes my bare feet and says,
Your shoes...
But before she can get them off, I stop her. I say that I don't mind. I like the look of it, her in my shoes. Her lying beside me in bed. I could get used to this. It's cold out here, I say. It's fucking cold, maybe 20 degrees.
It is?
She asks. I don't answer. I'll leave you alone, I say. Seems to me someone who chooses to freeze their ass off on a day like today wants to be alone. It's not as though anything happened, but lying beside her for all those hours just for the hell of it, just to be close to her, to feel the softness of her skin and the way her chest rattled when she snored, that happened.
Your feet must be freezing.
I glance at my feet. They stand on a thin layer of snow and ice. They are. I say. I turn to go inside.
Thanks for the coffee.
I don't know what I expect her to say, but I expect her to say something. Yep, I say, and let the door slam closed. I don't know how much time passes, enough that I start to get pissed. Pissed at myself for being pissed at her. I shouldn't care. I shouldn't give a shit. But then she appears. Her cheeks are ruby red from the cold. Her hair cascades around her.
I don't want to be alone,
she says. She drops the blanket at the door.
I can't remember the last time anyone told me I was beautiful,
she says. Beautiful doesn't do her justice. We stare at each other across the room, taking it all in, reminding ourselves to breathe. When she comes to me, she moves humbly. Her hands touch with caution. The last time I pushed her away, but the last time was different. She was a different woman. I was a different man. I run my hand the length of her hair. My hands move down her arms. They memorize her fingers and the shape of her back. She stares at me with this look I've never seen before. Not on her or any other woman. Trust. Respect. Desire. I commit to memory every freckle, every blemish on her face. I learn the shape of her ears and run a finger across the arch of her lips. She takes my hand and leads me to the bedroom. "You don't have to do this," I say. God knows she's no longer my prisoner. What I want is for her to want to be here. We pause in the doorway. Her lips find their way to mine, and I hold her head in my hands. My fingers stroke her hair. Her arms are locked behind my back. She doesn't let go. What changes is the way we touch. There's contact, something that we used to avoid. We graze past each other when we enter a room. She runs her fingers through my hair. I let my hand linger on her back. She traces the lines of my face. We share the same bed. Our hands and fingers memorize what our eyes could not. An uneven scalp, patches of dry skin. There's nothing frivolous about it. We don't flirt. We're beyond that. We don't dredge up past relationships. We don't try and make the other jealous. We don't create pet names. We don't mention the word love. We kill time. We talk. We list all the crazy things you see in the city. The homeless pushing shopping carts around. Jesus freaks walking around with crucifixes on their backs. Pigeons. She asks my favorite color. I say I don't have one. She asks my favorite food. I let a spoonful of slop drop into a bowl. "Anything other than this," I say. She asks what would have happened to her if we didn't come here, if I'd handed her over and collected my reward. "I don't know," I say.
"Would I be dead?"
We learn things we didn't know before. That skin-to-skin contact helps keep us warm. That SpaghettiOs and baked beans do mix. That two can fit on the shaky armchair. We're eating some meal. What it is, I don't know. We eat out of necessity. There's no such thing as breakfast, lunch, or dinner. It's all the same. It all tastes like shit. She's staring at me with those eyes of hers. They demand an answer. "I don't know," I say again. I see her being ripped from my car and tossed into the van, her hands bound and her eyes blindfolded. I hear her cry. I push my bowl away. I'm not hungry. I've lost my appetite. She stands and reaches for my bowl. She says she'll do the dishes tonight, but I gently clench her wrist when it comes within reach and say to her, "Leave it." We settle by the window where we watch the moon, a sliver in the sky. The clouds flicker by, and sometimes we see the moon, sometimes we don't.
"Look at all the stars,"
she says. She knows the names of the constellations, Aries, Fornax, Perseus. She says that in Chicago she used to wish on airplanes because there were far more of those floating around in the night sky than stars. There are times she's too far away, even when she's in the same room. She teaches me to count to 100 in Spanish. I teach her the foxtrot. When the lake freezes completely over, we ice fish. We never stay out long. She doesn't like to watch, so she walks on the lake as if Moses had parted the waters for her. She likes the newly fallen snow. Sometimes there are animal prints. Sometimes we hear snowmobiles in the distance. When she's frozen solid, she goes in. And then I feel alone. I take her outside. I bring the gun with me. We walk through the woods for a while, to a place so desolate I'm sure no one will hear the sound of a bullet exploding from the muzzle. I tell her that I want her to know how to shoot the gun. I give it to her flat, on both hands, like a piece of fine jewelry. She doesn't want to touch the damn thing. "Take it," I say, lightly.
Why?
She asks. Just in case. I want her to learn to shoot it so she can protect herself.
That's what you're here for.
What if one day I'm not? I ask. I tuck a strand of her hair behind a raw ear. I watch as the wind frees it again. It isn't loaded. She loops her thumb and forefinger through the trigger guard. She lifts it from my hands. It's heavy, the metal cold in the freezing temperatures. The ground is coated with snow. I place her finger on the trigger, wrap her palm around the grip. I move her thumb downward. I pull her left hand up to meet the right. My hand on hers assures her that she will be all right, that this will be all right. Her hands are cold, like mine. But they come to me without reserve, like they used to, pulling away when we touched. I tell her about the parts of the gun, the barrel and muzzle and trigger guard. I pull a magazine from the pocket of my jeans and show her how to attach it to the gun. I tell her about the kinds of guns there are, rifles and handguns and semi-automatics. This is a semi-automatic. When one round is fired, another round is loaded from the magazine into the chamber, all with the pull of the trigger. I tell her never to aim the gun at something she doesn't intend to kill. I learned this the hard way, I say, when I was 7, maybe 8. Some kid in the neighborhood. His old man owned a gun. He used to brag about it all the fucking time. I called him a liar. He wanted to prove it to me, so he went to his house after school. No one was home. His dad kept the thing in a bedside table, unlocked and loaded. I grabbed it from the drawer like it was a toy. We played a round of cops and robbers. He was the cop, but I had the gun. The kid said, "Hands up!" Then I turned and shot him. And then we stand there in the freezing cold. We remember the times she stared down the barrel of the gun. There's guilt and sorrow. I'm sure she sees it in my eyes. I'm sure she can hear it in my voice when I say, "I wouldn't have killed you." I'm clutching blindly to her hand.
"But you might have,"
she says. We both know it's the truth. "Yeah," I admit. I'm not one to say I'm sorry, but I'm sure the look on my face says it all.
"But that was different,"
she says. "How so?" I ask. She lets me shadow her from behind. I raise her arms, and together we aim at a nearby tree. I part her legs and show her how to stand, and then we cock the hammer and pull the trigger. The sound is deafening. The release of the bullet nearly knocks her off her feet. Bark explodes from the tree.
"Because if I'd have had the chance, I would have killed you too,"
she says. This is how we settle all those things that happened between us in the early days. This is how we make up for all the mean words that we said, for the horrible thoughts that ran through our minds. This is how we annul the violence and the hate of our first days and weeks in the cabin, inside the log walls that have now become our home.
"And your friend?"
she asks. I'm nodding to the gun in her hands. This time I want her to try by herself. Luckily for him, I had no aim when I was a kid. The bullet grazed the outside of his arm. A scratch.
Eve, Christmas Eve. Gabe called early in the morning to tell me he was on his way. It was just after 5:30 a.m. when my cell phone rang, and unlike James, who slept like a baby, I'd been awake for hours, plagued by another sleepless night. I don't bother to wake him. I find my robe and slippers and step outside. There's news. I stand on the front step, shivering from the cold, waiting for Gabe's car to pull into our snow-covered drive. It's after 6 o'clock and still dark outside. Neighbor's Christmas decor lights the night sky, decorated trees glittering through bay windows, icicle lights hanging from gutters, candles flickering in every single double-hung window that faces the street. From the chimneys, clouds of smoke swirl into the frosty air. I pull my robe tight around me and wait. I hear a train in the distance, rumbling through the town. No one waits besides its tracks before dawn on a Sunday morning, Christmas Eve. "What is it?" I ask when he parks his car and climbs out. He comes right up to me. He doesn't shut the door. "Let's go inside." He takes my hands and leads me where it's warm. We sit on the plush white sofa, pressed close together. We're hardly aware that our legs touch. It's dark in the house. Only the stove light in the kitchen is turned on. "I don't want to wake James," we whisper. There's a look in his eye, something new. "She's dead," I concede. "No," he says. But then he revises his statement and, staring down into his own hands, humbly admits, "I don't know." "There's a doctor in a tiny town in northeastern Minnesota, a Dr. Kayla Lee. I didn't want to get your hopes up. We received a call a week or so ago. She saw Mia's picture on the news and recognized her as a patient. It had been weeks, maybe a month, since Mia was in. But she's sure it's her. Mia was using a pseudonym, Chloe Romaine." "A doctor?" "Dr. Lee said that she was with a man, Colin Thatcher. She said that Mia was sick." "Sick?" "Pneumonia." "Pneumonia?" "Without treatment, pneumonia can lead to blood poisoning. It can lead to respiratory distress, the inability to breathe. Without treatment, a person can die." "She was given a prescription and sent home. The doctor asked to see her back in a week. Mia never returned for the appointment." Gabe said he had a nagging feeling about this Grand Marais. Something in his gut told him she might be there. "What made you think of Grand Marais?" I ask, remembering the day he showed up at my home, asking if I'd ever heard of it. "A postcard I came across at the Thatcher home, sent by Colin to his mother. For a boy who rarely left home, it caught my eye. A good place to hide." "There's more," he says. "What?" I beg. "She was given a prescription, but that doesn't mean it was ever filled. That doesn't mean the pills were ever taken." "I've been talking to Catherine Thatcher and doing some research into the Thatcher family. Turns out there's a cabin up in Grand Marais that's been in the family for years. Catherine says she doesn't know much about it. She's never been there, but her ex brought Colin there when he was a boy. It's a summer home, so to speak, inhabited only for a few months of the year. I sent an officer to check on the home, and when he did, he found a red truck with Illinois plates parked outside." "A red truck," I repeat. Gabe reminds me that Mrs. Thatcher's neighbors were sure Colin drove a truck. "And?" I ask anxiously. He stands to his feet. "I'm on my way. Driving there. This morning. I was going to take a flight, but there's no good way. No direct routes, and between layovers and connections..." I rise up to meet him. "I'm coming. Let me pack a..." I try to step past him. His hands seize me by the shoulders. "You can't come," he says in a gentle voice. He says this is only a hunch. There's no proof. The home is under surveillance right now. He's not even certain that Mia is there. Colin Thatcher is a dangerous man, wanted for much more than this. "I can," I cry. "She's my daughter." "Eve." My voice is uneven. My hands shake. I've waited for months for this moment, and now that it has arrived, I'm not certain I'm ready. There's so much that could go wrong. She needs me right now. I'm her mother, Gabe. It's my duty to protect her. He embraces me, a burly bear hug. "It's my duty to protect you," he says. "Trust me. If she's there, I will bring her home." "I can't lose her now," I cry. My eyes stray to a family photograph we had done years ago. James, Grace, Mia, and me, Everyone else looks as if they were forced to be there, with artificial smiles plastered to furrowed brows and rolling eyes, even me. But Mia simply looks happy. Why, I wonder? We never gave her a reason to be happy. Gabe lowers his lips to my forehead and holds them there, pressed tightly against the creased skin. This is how we stand when James comes hobbling down the steps, dressed in a pair of tight-fitting tartan pajamas.
"What the hell is this?"
he demands. I'm the first to pull away. "James," I say, hurrying to meet him in the foyer. "They found Mia." But his eyes brush past me and he evades my greeting. "And this is how you break the news?" he challenges, deriding Gabe. "By putting the moves on my wife?" "James," I say again, reaching for his hand so that he'll understand, "our daughter is coming home. They found Mia." But James replies with a patronizing look in Gabe's direction. He doesn't look at me.
"I'll believe it when I see it," he says, and walks out of the room.
Colin, before. There are lights on the Christmas tree. I won't tell her how they got there. I said she wouldn't like it. I said that someone else's loss is our gain. She says they look absolutely gorgeous at night when we turn off the lights and lay side by side in the dark, with just the lights from the Christmas tree and the fire.
"This is perfect," she says.
"This isn't good enough," I say.
"What do you mean?"
she asks.
"It's perfect."
But we both know it's far from perfect. What is perfect is the way she looks at me, and the way she says my name. The way her hand strokes my hair, though I don't think she knows she's doing it. The way we lay together night after night. The way I feel. Complete. What is perfect is the way she sometimes smiles and she sometimes laughs. The way we can say anything that comes to mind, or sit together for hours in absolute silence. The cat lies by us during the day. He sleeps with us at night, on her pillow where there's an ounce of warmth. I tell her to shoo him away, but she won't. So she moves closer to me. She shares mine instead. She feeds the cat table scraps, which he devours, but we both know that as the cabinet's empty, she will have to decide, us or him. We talk about where we would go if we had the chance. I list everywhere I can possibly think of that's warm. Mexico, Costa Rica, Egypt, the Sudan.
The Sudan?
Why not? It gets hot.
You're that cold?
She asks. I pull her on top of me. I'm getting warmer, I say. I ask her where she'd want to go, if we ever got out of here.
There's a town in Italy, she says. A ghost town. It's all but abandoned, lost in olive trees. A nearly non-existent town of only a couple hundred people, with a medieval castle and an old church.
This is where you want to go? I'm surprised. I expected Machu Picchu or Hawaii, something along those lines. But I can tell she's been thinking about it.
It's the kind of place we could slip in. It's a world apart from TVs and technology. It's in Liguria, this part of Italy that borders the south of France. We'd only be miles from the Italian Riviera. We could live off the land and grow our own food. We wouldn't have to rely on others. We wouldn't have to worry about being caught or found or...
I'm giving her a look.
You think it's stupid?
She says. I think fresh vegetables would be a nice change from stewed tomatoes.
I hate stewed tomatoes,
she admits. I say that I hate them too. I only got them because I was in a rush.
We could find a rustic old home, one of those granite monstrosities, one, I don't know, maybe 200 years old. We'd have breathtaking views of the mountains, maybe the coastline if we're lucky. We could raise animals, grow our own food.
Grapes?
We could have a vineyard and change our names, get a new start.
I sit up on my elbows. Who would you be?
What do you mean?
Your new name. The answer seems obvious.
Chloe.
Chloe. Then that's who you'll be, I say. I consider the name, Chloe, I remember the day, months ago, when we were driving in the truck back to Grand Marais. I forced her to pick a name, and she came up with Chloe. Why Chloe? I ask.
What do you mean?
That day, when I told you you couldn't be Mia anymore, and you said Chloe.
Oh,
she says, and she sits up straight. There are creases on her face from my shirt. Her hair is long. It goes halfway down her back, maybe more. I'm waiting for a simple answer. I just like it, something like that. But what I get is more.
Just some girl I saw on TV.
What do you mean? She closes her eyes. I know she doesn't want to tell me. But she does anyway.
I was 6 or 7 years old. My mother was in the kitchen, but she left the TV on, the news. I was coloring. She didn't know I was paying attention. There was a story, a high school band trip from some school, Kansas or Oklahoma, something like that. There was a group of kids in a bus traveling to a competition or something. I don't know. I wasn't really paying attention to that. The bus skidded off the road and went down a ravine. Half a dozen kids were killed, the driver. Then this family appears, a mom, a dad, and two older boys, maybe 18 or 19. I can still see them. The dad, gaunt with a receding hairline. The boys, both of them, tall and lanky like basketball players with burnt orange hair. The mother looked like she'd been run over by an 18-wheeler. They're crying, every single one of them, standing before this little white house. That's what made me pay attention. The crying. They were heartbroken, destroyed. I watched the father, mostly, but all of them, really, the way they openly wept for their dead daughter, their dead sister. She'd been killed in the accident, plunged down the ravine when the driver fell asleep at the wheel. She was 15, but I remember her father gushing about his baby girl. He went on and on about how amazing she was, though the things he said, that she was kind and silly and born to play the flute, were not necessarily amazing. But to him they were. He kept saying, "My Chloe," or "My baby Chloe." That was her name, Chloe Frost. All I could think about was Chloe Frost. I wanted to be her, to have someone long for me the way her family longed for her. I cried for Chloe, for days on end. I spoke to her when I was alone. I carried on conversations with my dead friend Chloe. I drew pictures of her, dozens of them, with her own burnt orange hair and coffee-colored eyes.
She runs her hands through her hair and looks away, in a sheepish sort of way, embarrassed. Then she admits,
"I was jealous of her, really. Jealous that she was dead. Jealous that somewhere out there someone loved her more than they loved me."
She hesitates, then says,
"It's crazy, I know."
But I shake my head and say, "No, because I know it's what she wants to hear. But I think how lonely she must have been growing up, longing for a dead friend she didn't even know. Things weren't so grand for Ma and me, but at least we weren't alone." She changes the subject. She doesn't want to talk about Chloe Frost anymore.
"Who will you be?"
she asks. "John?" I say. I couldn't be further from a John.
"No,"
she says, the answer almost as obvious as Chloe had been.
"You'll be Owen. Because it doesn't matter anyway, does it? That's not your real name."
"Do you want to know?" I ask. I bet she's thought about it a million times. I bet she's guessed to herself what my real name might be. I wonder if she ever thought about asking.
"No,"
she says.
"Because this is who you are to me. You're Owen."
She says that whoever I was before this doesn't matter. "And you'll be Chloe."
"I'll be Chloe."
And in that moment, Mia ceased to exist.
Eve, after. I consult with Dr. Rhodes. She agrees under one condition, that she is allowed to go along too. I purchase the 3 airplane tickets with the credit card that James and I share. The police department pays Gabe's fare. We will be revisiting the cabin in which Mia was held prisoner all that time. The hope is that being there will help jog her memory and make her remember something about her time in captivity. If the cat alone can trigger memories of Colin Thatcher, then I wonder what that cabin will do. Mia and I pack one bag. Between us, we don't have much. I never mention to James where we are going. Mia asked Sayana to watch Canoe for a few days, and the woman agrees without reservation. Her 9-year-old son, Ronnie, is thrilled to have a cat to keep company. We ask the taxi to drive us to her apartment on the way to O'Hare. It's with great difficulty that Mia is able to part with Canoe for the second time. I wonder what happened the first time she said goodbye. The airport is a horrendous place for a person in Mia's condition. The noise is deafening. Thousands of people, loudspeakers, airplanes soaring overhead. Mia is on edge. We all see it, though she's tucked between Dr. Rhodes and me, and I have her arm looped through mine. Dr. Rhodes suggests a dose of Valium, which she has brought along in her suitcase just in case. Gabe peers over.
"What else have you got in there?" he asks.
The 4 of us are sitting in a row at our terminal.
"Other sedatives," she replies, "stronger sedatives."
He sits back and reaches for a newspaper that someone has left behind.
"Is it safe?" I ask,
for the baby? Mia finishes impassively. I can't bring myself to say the word. "Yes," I say, humbled that she was able to.
"It's safe," the doctor reassures us. "This once. I wouldn't suggest using it frequently during pregnancy."
Mia takes the pills with a sip of water and then we wait. By the time our flight is announced, she's nearly asleep. We will fly to Minneapolis, St. Paul, for a 45-minute layover before continuing on to Duluth, Minnesota. There is a so-called friend of Gabe's, Detective Roger Hamill, will meet and drive us to Grand Marais. He refers to him as his friend, but even I can hear the disdain in his voice when he speaks of this man. Our flight is early, 9 a.m., and as the airplane ascends into the dreadfully cold sky, we know it will be a long day. Our only saving grace is that Mia is asleep. Mia and I sit side by side. She has the window seat, and me the aisle. Gabe sits opposite the slender aisle and once or twice brushes a hand against my arm and asks if I'm okay. Beside him, Dr. Rhodes is lost in an audiobook, the headphones covering her ears. The rest of the plane is oblivious to our situation. They jabber on and on about the weather, skiing conditions, and their connecting flights. A woman loses herself in the "Our Father" as the plane takes off, praying we land in one piece. She grips a rosary in her trembling hands. The pilot warns of a bumpy flight and asks that we remain in our seats. By the time we land in Minneapolis, Mia has come to and is upset once again by the commotion. I ask the doctor when she is due for more medicine, but Dr. Rhodes assures me that we must wait. We need Mia to be lucid for this afternoon. As we wait for our connection, Gabe offers up an iPod for Mia and finds the least offensive music he can possibly find to drown out the sound. I wonder what will happen when we arrive. The thought of it is enough to make me sick. I think of Mia's reaction to the cat. What will her reaction be when we see the place where she was held prisoner all this time? I think of the progress we've made since she returned home. Will it be lost? I excuse myself to use the bathroom, and Dr. Rhodes takes my seat beside Mia so that she won't be alone. When I come out of the bathroom, Gabe is waiting for me. I walk into him so that he collects me in his arms and says,
"Soon this will all be through. Trust me."
I do. In Duluth, we're escorted to a police department SUV by a man who introduces himself as Detective Hamill. Gabe calls him Roger.
Mia says it's nice to meet him, though Gabe reminds me that it isn't the first time they've met. He's a big-bellied man, about my age, but to me he looks much older, and I'm made aware that I'm getting older by the day. There's a photograph of his wife taped to the inside of the SUV, an overweight blonde woman with a circle of children huddled around them. There are six children, each as burly and plump as the next. Mia, Dr. Rhodes, and I slide into the back seat while Gabe takes the front. He offered it to me, but I happily refused, not up to the burdensome task of small talk. The drive is over 2 hours. Gabe and Detective Hamill lose themselves in idle banter about police work. They try to one-up one another, and I can tell that Gabe does not like the man. Gabe's voice is not overly friendly, and at times he is short, though for the benefit of us women he remains civil. He tries to speak to me and me more than our chauffeur, and for much of the drive, the rest of us sit in silence while Detective Hamill gives a soliloquy on 2 Timberwolves wins this season against the Chicago Bulls. I have no knowledge of professional sports. We travel along Highway 61 for the bulk of the journey, riding in part along the shores of Lake Superior. Mia's eyes are steadfast on the waters. I wonder if she's seen them before. "Anything look familiar?" Gabe asks more than once. He asks all the questions I don't have the courage to. Earlier, Dr. Rhodes made it clear that Gabe should not pry too hard. Gabe made it clear that he had a job to do. Hers was to pick up the pieces when they fell. "Assuming the shortest distance between 2 points is a straight line," Detective Hamill says, peering at Mia in the rearview mirror, "you would have traveled this path." We pass through Grand Marais and take a path known as the Gunflint Trail. Detective Hamill is a wealth of information, although little he has to offer is new to me, having memorized every detail of the scenic byway in the sleepless nights since Mia returned. We travel along a 2-lane road through the Superior National Forest, surrounded by more vegetation than I believe I've ever seen in my entire life. Much of the greenery is dead now, buried under mounds of snow. It will not be unearthed until spring. The evergreen trees embrace the snow in their needles, where they lie heavy from the weight. What I see in Mia as we continue along our journey is a straighter posture, her eyes more attuned to the outdoors. Not a glassy-eyed look like I've seen in the past, but an awareness and an interest. Dr. Rhodes is instructing Mia in visualization and repetitive affirmations. I can do this. I can hear James now mocking the woman for her irrational techniques. "Do you recognize anything now?" Gabe asks. He's turned around in his seat and she shakes her head. It's late afternoon, 3, maybe 4 o'clock, and already the sky is becoming dark. Clouds fill the sky, and though the heat runs steady, my hands and toes begin to numb. The heater cannot compete with the sub-zero temperatures outside. "Damn good thing you got out when you did," Detective Hamill says to Mia. "You never would have survived the winter." The thought sends a chill through me. Had Colin Thatcher not killed her, Mother Nature would have done the job herself. "Ah," Gabe says to lighten the mood. He sees something pass through me that he doesn't like. "You'd be surprised. Mia's quite a fighter, isn't that right?" he asks with a wink. And then he mouths the words that only she and I see. "You can do this." As the tires of the SUV hit a mound of snow, and we all turn and find ourselves face to face with the bleak log cabin. She's seen the pictures. There were so many times I found her sitting lethargically, staring at images of this very cabin, or staring into the vacant eyes of Colin Thatcher and seeing nothing. But now she sees something. Detective Hamill opens the door,
and like a magnetic force, Mia emerges from the car and I have to stop her. Mia, your hat, I say, your scarf. Because it's so cold out here, the very air will freeze her flesh. But Mia seems completely unaware of the cold, and I have to force the gloves onto her hands like she's a 5-year-old child. Her eyes are lost on this cabin, on the stack of steps that lead from the snow-covered drive to a door that's been barred with yellow caution tape. Snow covers the steps, though footprints remain, and tire tracks in the drive suggest that someone has been here since the last snowfall. The snow is everywhere, on the roof, the porch, the uninhabited world around the home. I wonder how Mia felt arriving at this home. So remote, one might believe they are the last inhabitants on Earth. I shiver at the thought of it. There's the lake that I've seen in Mia's pictures, frozen over 1,000 times, unlikely to thaw before spring. I'm overwhelmed with such feelings of loneliness and despair that I don't see Mia making her way up the steps with comfort and familiarity. Gabe reaches her first and offers to help. The steps are slick, and more than once her feet slip. At the top, they wait for Detective Hamill to unlock the door. Dr. Rhodes and I follow close behind. The detective presses the door open and it creaks. The rest of us fight for a look inside, but it's Gabe, with his general decorum, who says to Mia, "Ladies first," though he follows close behind.
Gabe, Christmas Eve. Somewhere in Minnesota, it begins to snow. I drive as fast as I can, which isn't fast enough. It's hard to see through the windshield, though the wipers go as fast as they can. This is every 6-year-old's dream, snow on Christmas Eve. Tonight Santa will come, his sleigh loaded with gifts for every girl and boy. Detective Hamill calls. He's got a couple of guys keeping the cabin under surveillance. He told me about it. A little cabin lost out in the woods. But they haven't seen anyone come or go. They haven't gotten a visual of anyone on the inside. By the time I arrive, he plans to have a team assembled. 10 or so of his best guys. This is a big deal around here. It's not every day that this kind of thing happens. I think of Eve. I go over it 1,000 times in my mind. What I will say, the words I will use to convey the good news. And then I consider the possibility that there isn't good news, that Mia isn't in the cabin, or that she doesn't survive the rescue. There are a million things that could go wrong. By the time I make my way up the coast of Lake Superior, Roger's guys are getting antsy. He's got a half dozen of them headed out to the woods. They set up a perimeter. They're armed with the department's best firepower. Detective Hamill is a man on a mission. Seems he has something to prove. No one takes a shot until I get there, I say as I gun the engine along a narrow, snow-covered road. The tires skid and I struggle to regain control. Scares the shit out of me. But what worries me more is the brassiness in the detective's voice. Even more than me. He's a guy led into the line of duty by the prospect of carrying a gun. It's Christmas Eve, Hoffman. My guys have families to see. I'm doing the best that I can. The sun sets and it's dark out here. I floor it. I fly through the narrow pass, nearly decapitating myself on branches that hang low from the weight of the snow. I don't know how many times I come to a near standstill. The tires kicking up snow and going absolutely nowhere. This piece of shit car is gonna get me killed. I'm going as fast as I can, knowing I need to get to Thatcher before Detective Hamill does. There's no telling what that guy might do.
Colin, Christmas Eve. This afternoon I returned to town and put in a call to Dan. Everything's ready to go. He says he'll meet us on the 26th in Milwaukee. It's the best he could do. The guy wasn't about to drive all the fucking way to Grand Marais. He made that clear. It's my Christmas present for her, a surprise for tomorrow. We'll leave by sundown and drive all night. It's the safest way. I suggest we meet at the zoo, nice public place, open Christmas Day. I've gone through it in my mind 1,000 times. We'll park in the lot. She'll hide out in the primate house. I'll meet Dan by the wolves. I find her when he's gone, when I'm sure we aren't being trailed. From there, the quickest way to Canada is in Windsor, Ontario. We'll drive into Windsor, and then as far as we can get on the gas money we have. I have enough cash to get us there. And then it will be gone. We'll live under pseudonyms. I'll get a job. I've got Dan working on a fake ID for Ma, too, and when I can, I'll get it to her. Somehow. When I figure that part out. I know this is my last night in this shitty old cabin. She doesn't. I'm secretly saying my goodbyes. Tomorrow is Christmas Day. I remember that when I was a kid, I'd leave the house early on Christmas Day. I'd count out $1.02 from a change jar we kept. I'd walk to the bakery at the corner. They were open until noon on Christmas. We pretended it was a surprise, though it never was. Ma would lie in bed long enough to hear me sneak out the front door. I never went straight to the bakery. I'd be a peeping Tom, staring